The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Another day with the Greek letter Omicron top of mind. We'll have the latest, including how the world's airports are dealing with it. Also today, in Lebanon, political power is divvied up by sectarian groups. A new generation says that whole system needs to go.
Imagine in the United States if I want to say, you know, the number of people with green eyes get to have these public positions, and the number of people with brown eyes get to have those public positions. And let's see if green eyes and blue eyes and brown eyes can coexist together.
And designing a smarter building in Sweden means reduce, reuse, and recycle, especially the water.
The biggest reaction we get from the tenants here is that they're kind of uncomfortable showering in recycled water.
But when they find out it's cleaner than the tap, time to shampoo and condition. I'm Carol Hills. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Just 5 days after being declared a new coronavirus variant of concern, Omicron has now been detected in more than 20 countries. And as of this afternoon, that list includes the U.S. Officials say a first case of the Omicron variant was identified in California. Scientists don't yet know how serious the new variant could be, but Omicron is unquestionably a big flashing light, a reminder that this pandemic is far from over. Today, global leaders reached a pretty momentous agreement. Here to unpack the latest developments is The World's Alana Gordon, who covers global health for our show. Alana, we'll get to today's meeting in just a bit. But first, though, Omicron, how widespread is it at this point?
Well, Carol, earlier today, the World Health Organization reported that it's been detected in at least 23 countries, and that spans all but one region of the world. The WHO said we should expect to see those numbers grow because this coronavirus, whatever the variant, you know, it's spreading in general.
But we still don't know much about how serious it is. Is that right?
That's right. It's too soon to say. And scientists are working really hard to figure out those answers. Maria Van Kerkhove, the technical lead for the WHO, she said today part of what's tricky in the real world is that even if hospitalizations are up in places like South Africa right now, where there have been lots of cases of Omicron, we don't know whether that's because infections are up in general. Because even with Delta, for example, we know that a portion of people will still get really sick. But she did also say we'll have more answers to some of these questions about whether Omicron can spread more easily compared to Delta really soon. Again, here's Maria Van Kerkhove.
We expect to have more information on transmission within days, not necessarily weeks, but in days.
Okay, but during this holding period, countries are taking matters into their own hands. How are the responses varying?
Well, in the U.S., we may soon see more screenings of international travelers, vaccinated or not, who may have to show proof of a negative test within a day of traveling. The EU is now considering mandatory vaccinations within the bloc. You know, Japan has suspended all incoming flights. Israel and Morocco have also enacted similar policies. The WHO now recommends that anyone who isn't vaccinated or hasn't been infected before and is at higher risk for COVID, so people who are over the age of 60 or have other health issues, they're recommending that they actually not travel right now to places that have community transmission. Again, WHO's Maria Van Kerkhove, she really stresses that Omicron may be a new variant, but the way to prevent it is not new.
The more this virus circulates, the more infections there will be. The more infections there will be, the more people will die. And this is something that can be prevented. So everything that we can do for Delta, which is dominant worldwide, needs to be applied and strengthened for Omicron.
So when you think about ways that you can prevent or curb the spread through surveillance, distancing, masking even, vaccines. Kerkhove said it's really important to get them. And globally, she and others today said that it's really time to focus on getting vaccines to places that don't have them right now.
Hmm. So it's very timely, Ilana, that representatives from around the world agreed this week to negotiate some kind of new global agreement for future pandemic threats. WHO's Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus announced that today.
The nations of the world have made a strong statement that health security is too important to be left to chance or goodwill.
So a new negotiating body to develop some kind of global agreement. How important is that now and in the future?
Well, on the one hand, any kind of agreement could take years to hash out. I asked Suri Moon about all of this. She's a global health professor at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. She tells me this is actually really significant, that the world has now agreed on a process and a timeline to create a stronger set of international rules for addressing future pandemics.
It was a historical moment. It was a historical decision by governments to begin a negotiation process that can end up with a treaty. And it wasn't clear, I think, even just a week or so ago, whether we would have the kind of consensus that we saw today.
So, Carol, like the U.S., China, Russia, lots of countries were at odds over coming together on something. Moon says Omicron actually really set a tone of urgency, making clear that this current pandemic has been a failure in the global coordinated response. So there's definitely going to be points of tension in the upcoming talks, but there's also a broad consensus that issues of equity, leadership, animal to human transmission risks have to be central in better addressing any future threats.
Wow. The world's Ilana Gordon. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Carol.
A massive pandemic, a world leader urging people to get vaccinated. Sound familiar? But this time, the year is 1787, and the leader is Catherine the Great of Russia. One of her letters just sold at auction today. In it, she maps out a strategy for getting her country inoculated against smallpox. Russians were terrified of the procedure, and they had good reason to be. It involved slicing into a person's arm and grating smallpox pustules into the open wound. There was about a 2% chance you'd die from it. But Catherine the Great decided she would risk it.
She had long feared smallpox. It had been a scourge of European society in general.
Lynn Hartnett is a professor of Russian history at Villanova. She says in 1768, Catherine became the first person in Russia to get inoculated against the disease. Catherine brought in the English physician Thomas Dimmesdale to do the procedure.
Catherine was inoculated secretly. She had arranged for Dimmesdale to come to Russia incognito and had even arranged for a carriage to get him out of the country should things go wrong.
In other words, should he accidentally kill her? But all went well, and as soon as Catherine recovered, she went public with the news.
The Senate at the time commissioned coins, and holidays were put in place to celebrate when her and her son Paul, who she had inoculated soon after herself, recovered from the inoculation.
Hartnett says Catherine wanted to set an example and convince the vaccine skeptics of her day that the inoculation was safe.
She set up inoculation clinics in different parts of her empire, and she said she did this out of a maternal concern for her people.
The inoculation drive was only somewhat successful. 20 years later, she wrote a letter to the governor general of what is now Ukraine, telling him that inoculating the public should be his top priority and explaining how to do it. That is the letter that sold today for $1.3 million, a missive from a head of state who, in the face of fear, put her faith in science. Worldwide, almost a third of energy-related carbon dioxide emissions comes from buildings. It takes a lot of energy to heat and cool them and keep the lights on. Architects, engineers, and scientists have long experimented with making buildings smarter when it comes to energy use, even carbon neutral. Reporter Dave Kattenberg brings us this story from one such building in Sweden.
The Living Lab is a four-story building on the campus of Chalmers University of Technology in Göteborg, Sweden. Owned and operated by Sweden's largest housing cooperative, the Living Lab is home to 40 students and researchers. Their mission? To test out building technologies for a low-carbon future.
Hi there. I'm Madeline.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, welcome.
Madeline Dufree manages the Living Lab.
I was just up checking the apartment that you're going to stay in.
I spent a weekend at the Living Lab, cooking, washing up, and exploring. The building is packed with eye-catching devices and tangles of tech designed to lower energy and water consumption. Living Lab researchers monitor their use.
We have 2,000 sensors incorporated in the building structure that measure everything that the residents do, water usage, electricity usage, to determine if any new products or services that we install in the building have any effect, sustainability-wise.
Sweden gets cold in the winter, but there's plenty of geothermal heat to warm the Living Lab.
In the building, there is both district heating and a heat pump.
David Steen is an energy researcher here at the Living Lab. He and his colleagues have developed a host of energy-smart devices and are testing them out. An electric car charger that kicks in when solar batteries are full with the tap of a smartphone, and a washing machine that starts when electricity is cheapest and washes your clothes with low CO2 emissions.
The model can use different objectives. So you can use CO2 as one objective. You can use cost. So you use the spot market price for electricity and you choose to wash the clothes when it's cheapest. We also have solar PVs and a battery. So we are scheduling the batteries charging and discharging with this model as well.
Among the most remarkable systems at the Living Lab, a gray water recycling setup that filters sink and shower water, returning it to residents along with its heat, and cleaner than tap water. Swedish engineer Per Eriksson designed it.
We're taking the actual water with that energy or that heat in it, and we recycle it and put it back as warm water to the same shower, to make it simple. You get a circular system, and you reuse that energy over and over again.
Recycled shower water at the Living Lab was a tough sell for some.
The biggest reaction we get from the tenants here is that, they're kind of uncomfortable showering in recycled water.
They go, wait a minute, is this recycled water, is it clean?
That's the first reaction. But like everything that is new, it takes a while to get used to it. And once you understand that this water actually is cleaner than your tap water, that you're saving maybe over 50% of the energy and 60% of the water in a building, the coin drops. You can see it in their eyes. You go, damn, why haven't we done this before? This is so logical.
So now we are entering the chemistry lab.
Across campus from the Living Lab, a chemist named Kasper Mott-Poulsen is developing a little molecule that promises to revolutionize windows. It absorbs sunlight, shapeshifts to a high energy state, then returns to ground state, releasing heat. Mott-Poulsen is cooking it up by computer.
This is all computer controlled. So this setup here can do maybe 10 new experiments every hour, and this can make our discovery of new molecules go much faster.
Mass-produced, flowing through glass tubing on rooftops, Mott-Poulsen's little molecule could capture sunlight and release its heat into the buildings below, or it could be coated on windows that transfer heat inside after the sun's gone down. Back at the Living Lab, student resident Stig Robertson has washed his bedsheets and is now drying them in a chamber that uses no heat at all. He reflects on how urban dwellers squander energy and water resources and how they can do much better.
Living Lab is an interesting way to research new ways of living and maybe more effective ways of living, resource-effective way of living for the future.
Robertson is happy to be part of Living Lab experiments aimed at designing low-carbon buildings for people and for the planet. For the world, I'm David Kattenberg, Göteborg, Sweden.
How to help people in Afghanistan without helping the Taliban. The World Bank is trying to thread that needle with a massive aid package. That news is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. As winter approaches, Afghanistan is facing dire circumstances. The United Nations estimates that nearly 22 million Afghans, more than half the population, could experience a food shortage. The World Bank is trying to artfully get humanitarian help to Afghanistan without endorsing the Taliban. Reportedly, their plan is to redirect up to $500 million from a frozen Afghanistan aid fund directly to humanitarian agencies in the country. Alexander Matteo is in Kabul. He's with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, which has a major food relief and winter survival kits operation underway right now in the country. Alexander, you're on the ground in Afghanistan witnessing the situation firsthand. What are the most pressing humanitarian issues facing Afghans right now?
Well, Carol, the short answer to that is access to food and access to medicine. And there are a number of reasons why that is so complicated. Some of them are decades old. And then you add on top of that the events since August 2021, and there are two triggers there. One is that the severe banking crisis followed the change in government, which meant that people stopped being paid and couldn't access the money they had in accounts if they did have any savings. And secondly, the financing for the health programs in the country. That financing was cut off. So all of those things converged together to create a fairly significant humanitarian crisis.
So where you're sitting, the issues are kind of food, shelter, healthcare, the basic needs.
They are from where I'm sitting, but that's partly because of the organization I work for primarily focuses on humanitarian needs. As I mentioned, if you do speak to Afghans, if you listen to their personal stories, of course, there's more nuance to it than the basic survival needs. However, I mean, as an example, I was in the Panjshir Valley just yesterday meeting doctors there who hadn't been paid for 3 to 4 months. And one described how she was feeding her 4 children potato peel and nothing else each day.
Now, the international community has tried to kind of overcome a vexing problem, how to get aid to Afghanistan without endorsing or recognizing the Taliban government. Reportedly, the World Bank has a plan to redirect funds that are currently frozen and sending them directly toward humanitarian agencies in Afghanistan. This would be up to $500 million. Do you think that's a viable way around this dilemma?
Well, providing the Taliban agrees to it, because nothing can happen in this country without their endorsing and giving permission. But providing the agreement is there, there are ways of providing aid other than budget support. You can pay suppliers directly. You can have national partners. If you have national partners with legal identities in the country, they can hire staff directly. The World Bank would have to work through partners in country. They would choose big humanitarian agencies who have a presence here, who have a staff here and an infrastructure. This is all possible. It does all require at least collaboration with the Taliban, as they are the authorities in the country. They must approve access. They must allow any organization to deliver services. Pretending that is not true is not realistic.
What can the U.S. specifically do to try to help Afghanistan, especially through these next several months?
The U.S. is contributing generously to aid organizations, so there's no denying that, the largest contributions are still coming from the US, and we're very, very grateful for that. But even more importantly, then, is to really think about minimizing the negative humanitarian impact of any decisions on what sanctions are being applied to Afghanistan.
Is there an image you could leave us with, maybe people you've seen or communities or individuals in Afghanistan that we kind of need to think about?
I think I'll go back to the one that I mentioned. I was in the Panjshir Valley. I visited the only health clinic serving not only the town, but all the neighboring villages. So that's people who come to work every day with no salary, unable to feed their own children, and still trying to serve people who are vulnerable. They are not our enemy. They are fellow human beings who deserve better.
Alexander Matteo is Asia-Pacific Director for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. He's been speaking to us from Kabul. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Carol, for having me.
As drought conditions continue in Iran, so does unrest. Weeks of protests in the city of Isfahan resulted in a violent crackdown by the government late last week. Farmers, along with thousands of their supporters, gathered in a dried-up riverbed demanding water. In response, Iranian security forces with batons and guns set fire to the protesters' camps and sprayed crowds with tear gas. Joining me to discuss all of this is Kaveh Madani, a research professor at City College of New York and also a former deputy head of Iran's Department of Environment. Kaveh, how bad is the current drought in Iran, and how long has it been going on?
It is really bad. We have a natural drought this year. It's dry and less precipitation has come. But we are facing now a situation of water bankruptcy where the demand is much greater than the available water. But now also the farmers are being impacted. Bad planning, years of poor governance and lack of foresight have led to this situation.
The farmers in Iran are demanding that the government restore water to that river in Isfahan. Is that even possible?
It is not. This is the mission impossible. In a water bankruptcy situation, the first rule is that there is no enough water anyway. And that is what makes the situation challenging. You either have to cut water from the farmers or the cities or the industry. Whatever you do is problematic because if you get the farmers bankrupt, there would be chaos. If you shut down the industries, there would be unemployment. And then you cannot have a city without water. But people feel really injustice. And the lack of transparency in the system causes these clashes and a lot of anger and loss of hope, actually, into the future.
You mentioned anger, and in July, water protests actually turned violent in Iran's Khuzestan province. At least 4 people were killed. To what extent is this water issue becoming a national movement?
The situation is the same in many other parts of the country. Even in the wet areas, we are seeing problems. What I anticipate, unfortunately, is that unless the skies and the clouds are generous and provide some water to the Iranians, we might see these clashes in different parts. These things start as a water protest, but soon after, they're no longer water protests. Iran is facing lots of other issues, economic issues, inequality. All these things together provide a recipe for national security problems and chaos. And this is the scary part.
Kaveh, you used to run Iran's Department of Environment. You know this issue well. Besides rain, what is the solution for Iran's water shortage?
Unfortunately, in the short term, there is no magic solution which can address the problem. It might sound funny, but some of the ayatollahs now have prescribed saying the what they call the precipitation prayers. But in the short term, it's all about anger management. The system needs to compensate the farmers who have lost income, then divert the water to the most important uses. What needs to be done are the fundamental reforms to the water governance system in Iran to reduce the water consumption in the agriculture. You need to provide jobs in other sectors, alternative means of life for the farmers. Grow the industrial sector. You have to have more jobs and opportunities in the service sector. That means a more diversified economy. And unless those big decisions are made, I don't anticipate any improvement. And I see more and more environmental degradation and ecosystem collapses in different parts of the country.
Kaveh Madani is research professor at City College of New York. He's also the former deputy head of Iran's Department of Environment. He's been speaking to us from Toronto. Thanks a lot, Kaveh.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Korean neighborhoods are a fabric of many American cities, but the very first Koreatown in the U.S. nearly vanished from history until scholars in Riverside, California set the record straight.
This community was operated, owned, and run by Koreans. They had weddings. They had everything going on there. It was an actual community.
America's first Koreatown, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. Lebanon is dying a slow death. That assessment came from a top Lebanese politician this week. He's Christian and was blaming the Shiite Muslim group Hezbollah for Lebanon's political woes. A leader from Hezbollah responded, accusing the Christian leader of slander. It's yet another illustration of Lebanon's political problems. Sectarian groups are locked in an endless battle of you win, I lose. But in the past couple of years, a protest movement has taken shape to combat that mindset. As The World's Shirin Jafari reports, it's pushing for big changes in the country's sectarian power-sharing system.
Martyrs Square in Beirut became a second home for many protesters in 2019.
Tell me where your tent was exactly.
It was right under the flag.
That's where your tent was?
Yeah.
A meeting with one of them, Hussein Al-Ashi, who set up his own tent here and brought along a sleeping bag.
We say, I slept here, but we didn't really sleep. So, because we had so much energy coming from I don't know where.
Protesters like Ashi spent weeks at the square, chanting slogans and calling attention to their grievances, like the imploding economy, lack of jobs, and limited access to basic necessities like electricity, trash collection, and clean water. Ashi puts the blame on incompetent and corrupt politicians, but he also sees a problem with the political system that keeps these people in power.
The youth in this country have been completely excluded from political life. Sectarian politics ruled, identity politics ruled, tribal politics ruled before October 2019.
Lebanon's political system is based on sectarian power sharing among many different groups. Under this system, key government positions are divided between a Maronite Christian, a Sunni Muslim, and a Shiite Muslim. Bania Al-Masri is a political activist and lecturer at the Lebanese American University. She says the origins of this system in Lebanon goes as far back as the Second World War and the French and British colonial rule.
They saw us as an amalgamation of 17, 18 different sectarian affiliations, that they want us to coexist peacefully, which could not be more insulting or more ahistoric to how we are.
Masri says this sectarian system denies the Lebanese people a shared identity. It boxes them into the different sects into which they were born. Instead of focusing on national priorities, she says, politicians look out for people in their own group. They divvy up government jobs and funding not based on merit, but on political and sectarian allegiance.
Imagine in the United States if I want to say, you know, the number of people with green eyes get to have these public positions, and the number of people with brown eyes get to have those public positions. And let's see if green eyes and blue eyes and brown eyes can coexist together. And if you hear how absurd that is for you, that is how absurd it is for me to talk about Druze and Maronites and Greek Orthodox coexisting when they're all literally members of my same family.
Rania Al-Masri and Hossein Al-Ashi are both members of a younger generation in Lebanon that's looking for an end to the old sectarian-based political rules. They say this is the only way the country can pull itself out of the current chaos. But untangling a decades-old system that is embedded in so much of everyday life in Lebanon, and one that benefits powerful individuals, is not so easy.
So we're now in Tayuni, which is a big intersection, a big roundabout.
Habib Batta is a journalist in Beirut, and we've been working on stories together. He shows me around the Tayuni neighborhood. This is the place where just a few weeks ago, a fierce gun battle broke out between the supporters of the Shiite Amal Party and the Christian Lebanese Forces Party.
We can see two older buildings that have been shot up. You can see hundreds of bullet holes in the buildings to get broken glass.
At least six people died and several others were injured that day.
It was almost like we had a civil war, a mini civil war, from breakfast to lunch.
Atta says this part of town is mostly segregated. Shiite Muslims live on one side, Christians on the other. It's a painful legacy of Lebanon's 15-year civil war that started in 1975 when this city was divided between mainly Muslim and Christian neighborhoods. A demarcation line ran right here through this part of the city.
Since the war ended, we've had a number of smaller wars and flare-ups where the parties can still remind people about the violence of the war as a way of ensuring their power in some ways. You know, they can tell people, well, don't forget, this is still a war zone.
Not only that, in the absence of a functioning state in Lebanon, many people have to depend on sectarian groups for basic services. And so rejecting the whole sectarian system gets complicated. That's what Leah Buchhater told me. She's an expert on labor movements.
Some people have the luxury to say, well, I don't need them, because they can afford a private insurance, they can afford education, they can say, yeah, they are corrupt, I don't need them. But most of people don't have this luxury.
Lebanon is scheduled to hold an election next year, but activists Hossein Al-Ashi and Rania Al-Masri say they are not counting on elections to bring real change. Ashi has helped to start a new youth-led political group called Mintishreen. It's pushing for a secular state and a different social contract that's not based on sectarianism. Masri's party, called Citizens in a State, was established in 2016, but she says it has been getting lots of new members since the 2019 protests.
And we have received supporters from people who have left their sectarian political parties.
But Ashi says he's realistic, and he knows there are big challenges ahead.
Where we have weakness is one with the older generation, and we have a weakness if you go outside of urban centers, where the political sectarian parties really have a very strong hold of these communities.
Still, both of these Lebanese activists are convinced that the only way forward for this country is to build a new system that is not rooted in sectarian competition. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari, Beirut, Lebanon.
If you've been feeling a bit down or overwhelmed lately, just remember, things may be bad now, but it's only a moment in time. That's a line from Rokia Kone's song, Nyan Nyan. You can hear the whole thing and other tunes from around the globe on our Global Hits playlist. Find a link in our Twitter feed. We are at The World. As cases of the new COVID variant Omicron continue to pop up around the globe, many nations are rushing to tighten air travel rules. Japan has suspended new reservations on all incoming flights. Israel is barring entry to foreigners. Soon all passengers flying into the U.S. will likely have to be tested for COVID within one day of their flight, regardless of their vaccination status. Perry Flint has been watching the international airline industry scramble to respond to the raft of new regulations. He's the spokesperson for the International Air Transport Association. Perry, flying across borders was already a patchwork of country-by-country regulations before Omicron. Now it's even more complex. What's the industry doing to respond?
Carol, it's an extraordinarily frustrating moment for the airline industry at a point where it really looked like this late autumn winter season would be a bit brighter. And then to have governments respond in such a knee-jerk, almost Pavlovian fashion to the discovery of a new variant when scientists have been telling us all along to expect new variants is extraordinarily disappointing and just a huge setback, you know, for economies, for travelers, for families that were looking forward to getting together over the holidays. So just a very disappointing and difficult time for the industry.
I note the frustration in your voice. What's the industry doing to respond to all these changes that are happening so quickly?
Well, they're scrambling. It's that simple. The airlines themselves are, in effect, responsible for policing requirements. That's certainly the case, for example, for international travelers coming into the U.S. The airlines are responsible for, you know, making sure the requirements are observed. So it's quickly briefing ground staff, airport staff. It's, in some cases, it's reprogramming systems. If a test had a three-day efficacy period and now the government is saying, no, it's got to be a one-day test, you've got to make sure that, you know, the information you're providing to the passengers is updated to say one day. And when does it become one day? Is it going to become one day as of Sunday or Monday and so on and so forth? So it's just a scramble. The industry's doing their best. It's nothing to be happy about, but the fact that this sort of thing has been going on now for more than 18 months means there is some reservoir of experience of rapidly dealing with rapidly changing circumstances. But nevertheless, it's just extraordinarily difficult.
On the other hand, though, I mean, airlines are packing their planes as much as they can. Masking requirements are hard to enforce. Is the airline industry doing enough to protect its passengers?
We know, based on the experience of the past 18 to 20 months, that the risk of transmission on board an aircraft is quite low. It's certainly lower than in many other indoor environments, such as an office, such as a school, such as a grocery store. And that's owing to a number of factors. You touched on one, the wearing of face masks. But there's also the extremely high air exchange rates. There's the fact that passengers sit facing forward. And nothing that we've seen up till now has suggested that any of that changes.
At the beginning of this conversation, you sounded kind of frustrated with countries, you know, shutting down and suddenly testing and cutting travel routes. But countries don't really have much of a choice, do they?
I think countries do have a choice in terms of closing borders. It's not been shown to be effective. The latest variant is on every continent. We saw the same thing with Delta. I believe that governments are making a bad choice. It's a knee-jerk response. What does work is rigorous testing programs. They have been shown to work. In effect, closing a border is the same as shutting the barn door after the horse is bolted.
You mentioned testing, and the tests to get on a plane flying into the U.S., they're not cheap. Who should be footing the bill on pre-flight testing?
We believe governments should. So does the World Health Organization. If governments are going to require as a condition of entry that a passenger undergo a test of some sort, then it is incumbent on the government to pay for that test.
Perry Flint is the spokesperson for the International Air Transport Association. We've been talking about the patchwork of new global regulations to deal with air travel as we learn more about the Omicron COVID variant. Thanks a lot, Perry.
Thank you.
In Russia, prosecutors are trying to shut down that country's most prominent human rights organization. Memorial International opened its first branch in 1989. Today, there are dozens across Russia. The organization campaigns for human rights, and it also archives Soviet-era crimes. Now it is under threat in a courtroom. We're joined now by Sergei Davidis, a council member at the Memorial Human Rights Center in Moscow. Sergei, give us a bit of the history of Memorial. How did it start, and what is it known for in Russia?
You're absolutely right about foundation of Memorial, the whole movement in the end of 1980s. And academician Sakharov was one of the founders of this movement.
You're referring to Andrei Sakharov, the physicist and human rights campaigner.
Yes, academician Andrei Sakharov, well-known human rights defender. In the very beginning, its activity was devoted to the victims of repressions of Stalin's and more generally of Soviet period. But in 1993, Human Rights Center Memorial was organized as a separate organization, and the main sphere of its activity is current human rights violation. There are two legal entities which they want to liquidate.
So two of these human rights organizations now find themselves in court. Russian authorities are trying to shut them down. Why?
As for internal reasons of Russian authorities, it's difficult to say. I think this is just an issue of internal logic of repressive machine. It's technical reasons, for sure. There is also another reason, as mentioned, which is more dangerous. They say that we justify terrorism and extremism because we mention people who are declared to be terrorist or extremist in our political prisoners list. But you know, for example, all the Jehovah's Witnesses are declared to be extremist organization in Russia. So if you say they are not extremist, you justify extremism.
Sergei, do you see these court cases as a fight over Russian history and how it's presented to the public?
Actually, I would say that this court is about Russian civil society, about a possibility of independent look on our history. They want to have monopoly on the history, on human rights vision, and so on. And they do not want to have any competition in civil society.
What has Memorial's response been like, both inside and outside of court?
In court, for sure, we try to prove, relying on our constitution, on European convention, and our legislation. But we do not have independent court, so it was a political decision. And the only political decision may be made to take away these lawsuits. So we try to ask for support from all the people who believe that our activity is important, who believe that they are interested in a continuation of our activity, both in keeping historical memory and in defending human rights.
Will that make a difference? Or is this court case basically a show trial and Memorial doesn't have a chance of winning? I mean, what is the likelihood of Memorial being able to continue?
From legal point of view, for sure, there is no chance to win in Russian court in such a case, obviously politically motivated case. But the state can change, our authorities can change their demands. And if they order court not to liquidate us, then the court will not liquidate us. So for sure, probability of this outcome is very low. But as we say in Russian, the hope dies the last. So we keep the hope and fight, but for sure we should be ready for liquidation. They can liquidate legal entities, but not the ideas, not the people, not the demand from Russian society. Anyway, we are going to stay alive. Legal entity is not the main thing.
For those who don't know much about Russian history and some of the subjects that Memorial deals with, explain the importance of Memorial today. Why is it so important in this era?
If we speak about the activity of keeping historical memory, it's rather obvious. A huge period of our history, even after Stalin's time, it was impossible to speak about the victims, to speak about the repressions. And it's important to speak about them, not just to remember these people. It's important not only because of these people who were killed or unlawfully imprisoned. It's important in order to avoid possibility to repeat such situation in future. And now, unfortunately, our situation is getting worse and worse in this sense. So importance of historical memory, importance of memory about mass repressions is especially acute today.
Sergei Davidis is a council member at the Memorial Human Rights Center in Moscow. He's been speaking with us about Russian authorities' attempts to shut down Memorial and another human rights organization. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some communities vanish, others disappear slowly over time. Sometimes they're rediscovered. That's the case with what historians believe was the first Koreatown in the United States. It was located in Riverside, California from 1905 to 1913. At its peak, it had a population of 300 Koreans, complete with a language school, a community center, and a Presbyterian church. The story of America's first Koreatown is now being told in an exhibit at the University of California at Riverside. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with Carol Park, co-curator of the exhibit. Here's Marco.
Can you explain, Carol, how this community was rediscovered? It happened, I gather, only a few years ago by looking at an old map?
Yes. So Dr. Edward T. Chang, the founding director of the Yongwol Kim Center for Korean American Studies and a tenured professor in the Ethnic Studies Department at UC Riverside, was looking at some old Sanborn insurance maps. And he found one from 1908 that said Korean settlement. And it was an amazing find because no one had ever thought that there was a Korean settlement in Riverside, California, of all places. And so he took that little nugget and he went on just this amazing research project and discovered Korean newspaper articles from back then and discovered that indeed there was a Korean American community here in Riverside. And it all was born from looking at a Sanborn insurance map dated 1908.
So this first Koreatown was called the Pachapa Camp, named for the street it was on. Who actually founded this Koreatown in Riverside?
Dosan An Chang-ho, a very well-known Korean patriot and Korean independence movement activist, was the founder of Pachapa Camp. Korea had been basically annexed by Japan in 1910. So he was traveling all over the world saying, we need to do something to free our homeland. The way he founded it was through these principles and these ideologies. So the Koreans living at Pachapa Camp adhered to these rules and regulations set forth by Dosan An Chang-ho and the Korean Council that basically governed the community at Pachapa.
What is it, Carol, about this community of Korean immigrants that makes you and other historians consider it the first official Koreatown?
So prior to 1905, Koreans were being brought to Hawaii as sugar plantation laborers. And a lot of people think that a Koreatown was likely or possibly in Hawaii. However, those were labor camps. These labor camps were actually these facilities or camps that were provided by the plantations that these workers lived on. So it wasn't actually a community. And some people will say, oh, it was San Francisco. While there were Koreans, yes, in San Francisco, and they did live there, they did not form an actual community like this at Pachapa Camp, where there were men, women, and children living all together, renting this place, right? They had paid money and were able to basically rent that piece of land that had those 20 buildings. So this community was actually operated, owned, and run by Koreans who were both men, women, and also children living at this site, building cultural capital. And when I say cultural capital, I mean things like they had weddings, they had independence movement activities, they had everything going on there. It was an actual community.
So the community, Pachapa Camp, lasted only 8 years, from 1905 to 1913. What happened?
Because by 1913, the Great Citrus Freeze happened. And this freeze decimated the crops, the citrus crops all over, and basically reduced the number of jobs because there was nothing to pick anymore. And it was very difficult to recover from all of that. And so the Koreans that were living at Pachapa could no longer find jobs. And so they had to disperse. They had to go elsewhere. They had to follow where the jobs were. So many of them went up north of Los Angeles and thus ended the Pachapa Camp community.
As for Dosan An Chang Ho, he was eventually deported from the U.S., and the rest of his life was kind of tragic. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes. So Dosan An Chang Ho was accused of being a Bolshevist in 1925, and he was deported on March 2nd, 1926. And the accusation came from this letter that was sent to the U.S. Immigration Office, who decided to investigate Dosan for being a Bolshevist. They couldn't find no evidence of that, but they still deported him on March 2nd, 1926. And he ended up in Shanghai, China. And while he was there, he was arrested in 1932 in connection with the bombing, and he was sent to jail. And while in jail, he was tortured and he was mistreated. And eventually, the Japanese officials were worried that he would die in prison. So they released him to a hospital in Seoul, and he died there on March 10th, 1938.
Wow. Today in Riverside, Carol, what monuments or plaques are there that recognize this first Koreatown in the U.S.?
In 2016, December 2016, the City Council unanimously voted to mark the location of Pachapa Camp as its first point of cultural interest. And so what stands there today is actually a SoCal Gas fueling station and a sign that talks about or has a little paragraph about Pachapa Camp being the first Koreatown, USA, here in Riverside, California. So that's what's there now.
That's Carol Park speaking with The World's Marco Werman about the first Koreatown in the United States. Park is the co-curator of an exhibit called Pachapa Camp at the University of California, Riverside. Finally today, the results are in. The most expensive city in the world.
Hello, where are you from? First time at Tel Aviv.
A recent ad there telling tourists to come to Tel Aviv. But whether you visit or plan to stay, it'll cost you. Our partners at The Economist looked at cities across the globe and the cost of living index. That includes prices for clothing, fuel, food, and other goods and services. For the first time, an Israeli city topped the rankings that came out today. Anna Nichols with The Economist helped compile the list.
If you look at the actual data, the rise of Tel Aviv mainly reflects its currency. The shekel has been really strong against the US dollar. We measure our prices against New York City, so the US dollar exchange rate matters a lot. But there's also been quite a lot of price increases in Tel Aviv itself. So it's particularly an expensive place to buy alcohol. Personal care items are really expensive. Recreation, also expensive. So actually, it ranked in the top third for all of our major spending categories.
Nichols says other cities like Singapore, Zurich, and Hong Kong were not far behind.
In general, European and Asian cities were towards the top of the rankings. That was partly because of the currency rise, but it's also just because we've seen in Europe there have been quite big supply chain problems.
Anna Nichols with The Economist adds some good news for the U.S., though. American cities are falling behind. That's a good thing, meaning they become less expensive, at least relatively speaking. If you're wondering what city was knocked off the top, it's the City of Lights. Paris now ranks as the planet's second most expensive city. Thanks to our partners at the Intelligence Podcast from The Economist for sharing that with us. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being here.